Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 4th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article on Ruben Gallego from the Republic, and then we'll move on to environmental news. This first article is entitled Gallego in Political Spotlight, with the subtitle, But Some Voters Feel Betrayed. This is by Daniel Gonzalez and Ronald J. Hansen. Ruben Gallego's decision to co-sponsor the Laken-Riley Act, days after being sworn into the U.S. Senate, quickly cast the freshman Democrat into the national spotlight. The eye-opening move demonstrated that Gallego was willing to not only work with Republicans, but take the lead on passing legislation aimed at preventing violent crimes at the hands of immigrants, despite his own personal history as the son of Mexican and Colombian immigrants and his long record as a supporter of progressive immigration policies as a former Arizona lawmaker and U.S. representative. During a return to Arizona to meet with constituents, Gallego said he is committed to working with Republicans on immigration and border security measures that include targeted deportations of criminals, undocumented immigrants who have exhausted legal efforts to remain in the U.S. and recently arrived asylum without legitimate claims. Gallego said, as a senator, he decided to take a lead role on the Laken-Riley Act, which he had supported as a member of the House, because he was responding to what he heard from voters on the campaign trail, alarmed by the millions of migrants who had crossed the border illegally under the Biden administration. Certainly, that is what we heard on the campaign trail about the need for and want for saner actions, Gallego said. Many of the millions of migrants who arrived at the border had paid smugglers, who essentially functioned as travel agents, to help them get to Mexico and then help them cross the border illegally, Gallego said. Gallego called the surge that took place during the previous 3.5 years extremely different than what had happened in the past, and an absolute abuse of the asylum system. It created zero confidence in the government and in Democrats' position on immigration. And that is what actually changed my position, Gallego said in an interview with the Arizona Republic. I don't think we ever, in our intentions, when we created the asylum system, thought that we as a country would take in millions of people in that manner, Gallego said. I do think we need to have an asylum system, and I think we need to have one that is just, fair, and humane. But millions of people coming here is an absolute abuse and was not at all the intention of the asylum system when it was created, he said. And the American public saw it as that. Gallego made clear, however, that he opposes the Trump administration's mass deportation agenda, which, beyond deporting criminals, attempts to cast a wide net to deport as many immigrants in the country as possible, including those who have not committed crimes. Gallego opposes, for instance, the Trump administration's attempts to enlist local police to function as immigration enforcers. He called a new policy by the Trump administration to fly Venezuelan migrants to prisons in El Salvador bad because there is no due process. I would be fine if there was actually due process for us to determine whether these people are really dangerous, Gallego said. If they are, send them wherever they want, but there has to be due process. Gallego also said he remains committed to passing legislation that would allow Dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, to stay in the U.S. permanently and creating a legalization program that would allow undocumented immigrants with roots in the U.S. who have not caused problems to come out of the shadows. He said co-sponsoring the Laken-Riley Act as one of 100 members of the Senate gave him a leadership opportunity to help bridge the partisan divide over immigration down the road to achieve those goals, something he lacked as one of 435 members of the House. Most Americans believe, and this is my contention, and Latinos, want more border patrol. They want more border security. They don't want asylum to be abused, Gallego said. But they want their friends and neighbors that have been in this country illegally for sometimes decades, but have been good people, have not caused any crimes, they should have an opportunity to stay in this country. Still, Gallego said legalization programs for Dreamers and undocumented immigrants most likely will be impossible until Democrats retake control of the House, Senate, and White House, which Republicans now control. We've been through this dance. Republicans are not there. They're never going to be there. The problem with the Democrats is that when we had full control, we didn't actually take advantage of that situation and pass immigration reform, Gallego said. But in order for us to get the political will from the American public, they also have to trust us on border security. We do not have their trust on border security right now. Some supporters say they feel betrayed. Some of Gallego's biggest supporters saw his decision to take the extra step and co-sponsor the bill as a betrayal, especially for the son of immigrants and the first Latino elected to represent Arizona in the U.S. Senate. It landed as a retreat from the reputation honed as a state legislator who opposed Arizona's Senate Bill 1070, the state's immigration enforcement law, and the young member of Congress who stood with demonstrators protesting Trump's short-lived Muslim ban in 2017. Trump signed the Laken Riley Act on January 29th after Congress passed the legislation with bipartisan support that included Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, and Representative Greg Stanton, Democrat of Arizona. By co-sponsoring the bill as a U.S. senator from a border state, not to mention his Latino background, Gallego played a key role in generating the bipartisan support needed to pass the bill, which delivered the president an early victory on his mass deportation agenda. Gallego is a Latino. He comes from our community. He knows our struggle better than anybody, said Martin Cazada, a former Democratic state lawmaker dismayed by Gallego's support for the Laken Riley measure. From our own kind, from our own people, that cut goes a lot deeper for us. The Laken Riley Act serves as a milepost of sorts for Gallego, immigrants, and public opinion on crime and Trump's priorities. It's named for the 22-year-old college nursing student from Georgia who was slain in February 2024 while out for a run. A judge convicted Venezuelan migrant Jose Antonio Ibarra of her murder and sentenced him to life in prison. Trump and Gallego's Senate opponent, Republican Carrie Lake, made the case a focal point of their campaigns, with both pointing to Riley's death as a symbol of open border immigration policies. The resulting law that bears her name requires the Department of Homeland Security to detain and potentially deport immigrants charged, but not convicted, of crimes down to shoplifting. Ibarra entered the United States illegally in September 2022 and was released into the U.S. to challenge his immigration case. While that matter was pending, Ibarra picked up a minor citation in New York for operating a scooter without a license and later a shoplifting case in Georgia. Riley's violent demise stands out for its brutality and its rarity. Numerous studies have found that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born U.S. citizens. That was separately reaffirmed in 2024 by the left-leaning Brennan Center for Justice and the libertarian Cato Institute. While still in the U.S. House of Representatives and running for the Senate, Gallego voted for a similar measure last year. But it was his decision to co-sponsor the bill this year that rankled some in the immigration rights community who see the new law as denying immigrants due process and feeding into a Trump narrative that Latino immigrants are inherently dangerous. It was surprising, but also just alarming, said longtime Arizona immigrant activist Erica Andiola, who's critical of the bill's dragnet approach to immigration enforcement. I really think that he paved the way for that bill to pass the Senate. Quezada and other Latino progressive Democrats said they hoped the move was part of a larger political calculus by Gallego to gain Republican support down the road for a legalization program for Dreamers and other progressive immigration issues, but that seems unrealistic given Republican control in Washington. Gallego stood out, but wasn't alone. Trump signed the Laken Riley Act into law January 29th, the first bill of his second term, after Congress passed the bill with bipartisan support. Gallego was one of two Latino Democrats in the Senate who voted for the GOP-led bill. The other was Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada. In total, 12 Senate Democrats voted for the bill, among them Kelly, Arizona's senior senator. Gallego was one of two Democrats to co-sponsor the bill. The other was Senator John Fetterman, Democrat of Pennsylvania. Fetterman attended the signing ceremony at the White House. Gallego did not. Gallego's co-sponsorship generated a flurry of interviews with national media outlets, including the New York Times and Politico. Six of the 42 other members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus voted for the measure in both years. Four of them were not from competitive House districts or presidential swing states, and presumably did so with less political pressure. Although Trump carried Arizona, beating former Vice President Kamala Harris by more than 187,000 votes, Gallego defeated Lake by more than 80,000 votes, pulling off one of the most notable Democratic wins in the 2024 election. During the campaign, Gallego was endorsed by numerous progressive and Latino groups, among them the Latino Victory Fund, the Arizona Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and LULAC Adelante PAC. Gallego pointed to a split between advocacy groups and the groups they represent, at least on this issue. Immigrant advocacy groups didn't support the Laken Riley Act, but Gallego said Latino voters on the campaign trail did. "I go home, and there is a lot of support for bills like this," he told the Times. "The immigration groups have moved to the point where they somehow started representing that they represent the voice of Latinos, and they don't." During the campaign, Gallego also received support from other groups more supportive of what is cast as an anti-crime law. The Arizona Police Association, the largest law enforcement organization in the state, backed Gallego as well as Trump. "Kind of being closer to where your everyday Latino voter is on immigration is really what kind of helped set my policy mindset, because what you were hearing was entirely different from what you were hearing from groups and other opinion leaders about where Latinos were on the border and on immigration," Gallego told the Times. Rethinking who are Latinos. Trump's win and improved showing with Latino voters has led to a more fundamental reckoning on who speaks for that traditionally Democratic-leaning bloc. From the perspective of an elected official that's looking out for their entire constituency, and if you have identified or made claims that you're going to represent the Latino community, you start to ask yourself, well, who are Latinos? Said Arizona State University political science professor Francisco Pedraza. Pedraza noted that 9 of the 12 Democratic senators who voted for the Laken Riley Act were from states considered battleground states in 2024 that Trump won: Nevada, Michigan, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Arizona. Two others, Mark Warner, a Democrat from Virginia, and Jean Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire, are up for re-election in 2026. Only one Democrat from a swing state voted against the bill, Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin. Baldwin was re-elected in 2024 and, like Gallego, won't face voters again until 2030. By co-sponsoring the Laken Riley Act, Gallego also snatched an opportunity to make a quick name for himself in the Senate as a freshman Democrat, Pedraza said. having a very visible opportunity to take some leadership here and make a credible claim that he has a willingness to be bipartisan as the new John McCain of Arizona was probably important to him, Pedraza said. In the long run, Gallego also risks tossing away any political capital he gained by siding with Republicans to pass immigration reforms he favors because Republicans control the White House, the House, and the Senate, Pedraza said. The Laken Riley Act may have tapped into a concern for crime as significant in the Latino community as the broader republic, said Gabe Sanchez, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution who researches the Latino electorate. Latinos, like other groups, don't want criminals ignored, Sanchez said. Still, polling before the elections last year showed they were more focused on economic issues such as inflation and living wages, Sanchez said. And support for the Laken Riley Act could fall sharply among Latinos if the law is used to round up immigrants on minor charges such as shoplifting, said Sanchez, who teaches political science at the University of New Mexico. Do they support deportation of violent criminals? Overwhelmingly, Latinos, like all Americans, support that, he said. There's high support if they're violent criminals. But I've never seen data to suggest that Latinos would support somebody being deported for shoplifting, those type of more minor offenses. I would be shocked to see the majority of Latino voters support this act, given that it's a few steps below a violent criminal. Sanchez said activist organizations on both sides of the political spectrum tend to hold views that are more extreme than the demographic groups they represent. Younger Latino men were far more drawn to Trump and Republicans than other segments of the Latino population. For them, economic insecurity was a major issue, Sanchez said. Democrats seemed more inclined to debate whether that was an issue than to propose solutions to it, he said. Anti-crime or anti-immigrant? Gallego's decision to co-sponsor the Laken Riley Act caught the attention of some Latinos who voted for Trump. Mario Cruz Hernandez, age 54, a small business owner who runs Hernandez Brothers Painting in Phoenix, said he has been a registered Republican since he was 18. But he said he gained respect for Gallego after he announced his co-sponsorship of the Laken Riley Act. The decision, Hernandez said, showed at least he had an open mind to think maybe it is a good thing, unlike many Democrats in Congress who, when it comes to Trump, anything he does, they are against it. Hernandez said he voted for Trump and supports Trump's immigration crackdown. He also voted for Lake, but would now consider voting for Gallego based on his willingness to work with Republicans. Hernandez said he had a hard time understanding why anyone would oppose the bill, including progressive Latinos. The narrative is that the Trump administration hates Latinos, Hernandez said. Me being Mexican, I get it. There are a lot of great people who come here. My father was one of them. But there is a lot of people that come and cause crime. Is there a price and who pays? Meanwhile, many longtime immigrant advocates in Arizona can't understand how Gallego could empower Trump's aims. So many of my community members really feel like this Laken Riley Act is giving Trump the green light to continue to wreak havoc upon the immigrant community, said Annalise Ortiz, a Democratic state senator whose district covering the west side of Phoenix includes the largest Latino population in the state. Ortiz said she has knocked on thousands of doors in his district and frequently hears from Latino voters who are frustrated that Democrats keep promising to deliver immigration reforms, only to see some Democrats pass an immigration bill that will help Trump carry out his mass deportation agenda. Ortiz said she was deeply disappointed with Democratic members of Congress who didn't put up more of a fight to stop the bill or at least take out some of the worst parts of it that hurt dreamers and children of all ages who could be subject to deportation. But she said she was especially disappointed with Gallego's decision to co-sponsor the bill, which she believes promotes dangerous anti-immigrant rhetoric. It continues the harmful rhetoric and the lies that people who are here without authorization are inherently more dangerous, Ortiz said. We know that is not true. Yet our senator's co-sponsorship of this bill reiterates this false narrative, Ortiz said. In February 2023, a 24-year-old white supremacist was sentenced to 90 consecutive life sentences after opening fire in August 2019 at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, killing 23 people and injuring 22 others. The gunman, Patrick Wood Crucius, told police he was targeting Latinos to dissuade Mexicans and other Latinos from coming to the U.S. Andiola, a former undocumented immigrant whose undocumented mother is still battling in the immigration system to gain legal status, recalled standing with Gallego at news conferences in opposition to Arizona's immigration enforcement law, Senate Bill 1070, and former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's immigration sweeps. She said Gallego's decision to embrace Latino voters who supported Trump and his hardline immigration policies betrayed Latinos who voted for him because of his support for progressive immigration issues in the past. She believes Gallego's decision to co-sponsor the bill was rooted in political gain at the expense of immigrant communities without a clear political objective. Gallego believes right now he has to follow Trump's lead on immigration in order to continue to retain some of the Latino community who ended up supporting Trump. I don't really think that's the right strategy, Andiola said. I believe that it's important to acknowledge our folks who want to see a better economy, that they want to see a better future for themselves and their families. But it doesn't have to be at the expense of people like my family and others who are going to be paying the price. And that article was entitled Gallego in Political Spotlight, and that was by Daniel Gonzalez and Ronald J. Hansen. Next up, we have an article in The Environment entitled Climate Changemaker Says Love, Community Are Solutions. This is by Joan Miners. Less guru, more Velcro and glue. That's how Rhonda Bannard sees her role in the environmental movement. As a mom, businesswoman, former media professional, and just an average everyday person, she tries to bring her innovative thinking and networking skills to the table to build community and a better world. She doesn't have a degree in climate or environmental science. She just wants to help people find one another and work together to drive solutions forward. Bannard has spent her career doing this mostly with other women. For nearly 20 years, she's hosted a monthly Inspired Women's Salon, gathering together members of her Phoenix networks to discuss topics like courage, equality, and climate change. She's passionate about those issues, but she's perhaps more excited about the catalytic power of community. When I was divorced with two little kids and felt like I needed unity, what I valued most was meaningful conversation, Bannard said. I'm not a small talker. I like deeper conversations. That's where I get energized, listening and learning from other women and seeing connections happen. She's known for that energy and real talk in her circles around Phoenix and for using it to get things done. Before COVID shut down in-person gatherings for a time, she had arranged for a speaker to come to her women's group about championing a cause. But at the last minute, the speaker sent an 18-year-old Arizona State University freshman instead. That student, Brian Macinas, an organizer with Arizona Youth Climate Strike, spurred Bannard toward a new goal. He was so knowledgeable and so profound, Bannard said. There's a few kids I've met over my lifetime, and I thought, I want to be like you when I grow up. She ended up joining Macinas at some of the youth climate group gatherings, and before long, she found herself marching with them to the state capitol demanding climate action. And it was shortly after that I came back and said, what about a giving day for the environment, she said. Bannard was the right woman for the job. With decades of experience working with nonprofits and being named to the inaugural 40 Under 40 Leaders to Watch list put out by the Phoenix Business Journal as part of the Greater Phoenix Chamber of Commerce, she was savvy about fundraising. As a former journalist who covered agriculture and civil rights in Mississippi after graduating from the University of Arizona, she also knew how to connect with people on important issues and get the message out. In 2022, she launched the first giving day of her new nonprofit fundraising platform, Earth Gives, the result of recognizing a gap in funding for climate action, where only 2% of philanthropy ends up going to organizations focused on climate solutions, despite much higher enthusiasm for this cause. The number one reason climate orgs only get 2% is that it's hard to tell the story if there's no immediate action, Bannard said. If you're planting a tree, then you see a tree, but the work to absorb carbon and all that stuff is less visible, and that's part of the reason why the funding is so low. Animal rescues, wildlife protection efforts, and some of the big household name conservation groups siphon off a lot of the money people give to broad environment platforms, she said. It's a very small nut that's left over for climate-specific, boots-on-the-ground work. She thinks there needs to be more direct support for addressing climate change. So she put together the Earth Gives platform. Right now, it mostly functions to help donors find climate organizations to support during the main giving window, starting this year on September 5th and leading up to Earth Gives Day on October 7th. Registration for nonprofits wanting to solicit donations is open now through August 22nd. But eventually, she hopes to build Earth Gives to the point where she can employ an accountant year-round and seamlessly funnel donations to groups working on conservation issues, climate justice, biodiversity preservation, nature podcasts, documentaries, and more. Then it would become the type of thing where you can discover organizations. You can find their events. You can sign up to volunteer, Bannard said. It's another tool in their toolbox. I hope one day it really becomes the go-to place for everyone involved. In the meantime, Bannard is building the platform's offerings by hosting monthly community commons sessions for environmental nonprofits to convene and learn from one another about how to organize and tell their stories using tools like graphics and art. She draws inspiration from the corporate social responsibility guidelines pioneered by Patagonia, a company leading the way on ethical and sustainable practices. She's been following the Patagonia sensibility of lifting each other up and recognizing shared responsibility to the planet and one another since getting involved with nonprofits decades ago. Capitalism doesn't have to be just about consumerism, and she hopes Earth Gives can show that. It's not just about monetary transactions, she said. It's actually a shift in how you show up in the world and how you exist in all of your thinking. Bannard is also motivated by the work of other women, like those in her community salons, on behalf of the planet and future generations. The reason I'm doing this is because I'm a mom, she said. She has a 26-year-old daughter who studied biology at Northern Arizona University and a 24-year-old son who learned filmmaking skills at the University of Arizona that he now uses to help his mom edit her Earth Gives videos. I'm very concerned about now and our future. I'm inspired by our youth and what we need to do together. Dads can be climate champions. The movement has Al Gore, she notes, and his Climate Reality Project. But when you look around the climate nonprofit action space, it's made up of a lot of moms. Groups like Science Moms and Moms Clean Air Force fighting for a cleaner, better future with a more stabilized and livable environment. I believe women are the change makers, she said. When you want to get shit done, you call busy women and you make it happen. We're the protectors. I mean, the Earth is called Mother for a reason. She's been taking care of us, and we need to take care of her. in the end, what Bannard has learned most through all her community building and nonprofit activating is that it's all about love. It's just always fascinating how these conversations go and how it comes down to joy and love and community and bringing people together, she said. I mean, that's what really fills my heart, connecting with people through words and meaningful moments. That's how you build and advance change in the world. And that article is entitled, Climate Changemaker Says Love, Community Are Solutions. And that was by Joe Miners. This is part of a monthly series highlighting Arizona's climate leaders and answering readers' climate-related questions. The stories, which appear in print and online the first Sunday of the month, aim to help to connect and inspire Arizonans who care about protecting a livable climate and may be struggling to find hope in that effort lately. You can nominate an unsung Arizona climate leader for a story or ask a question by filling out the form at https://forms.gle/QCCXBPSHGY1BUJQ99 or by emailing climate reporter Joan Miners at joan.miners, that's M-E-I-N-E-R-S, at arizonarepublic.com. We're approximately 31 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 4th, 2025. We're going to move on to Valley and State News with this next article entitled, Santan Valley Residents Will Get to Decide Their Future. This is by Maritza Dominguez. Pinal County has verified the signature submitted by the Santan Valley Incorporation Committee, marking the last major step for the group needed to get the question on the ballot. The committee filed more than 10,500 signatures, and the county found 7,531 of those signatures were valid. The group was required to file at least 6,107 to the county to qualify and put the question to the voters. No member of the public filed a complaint to challenge the signatures, nor has anyone filed campaign finance paperwork for an anti-incorporation campaign. Santan Valley voters will get the chance to answer the question, do they want to become an official town? Residents within the 34.6 square miles defining the area to be incorporated are expected to cast their decision on August 5th. The Pinal County Board of Supervisors will vote to call the election at a May 2nd special meeting. It's expected to be held like a regular election with mail-in, early voting, and election day in-person voting, according to the county. The Santan Valley area has nearly 100,000 residents. In 2018, the county projected the area's population, including areas not within the proposed town boundaries, could reach about 310,000 fully built out. The effort is a turning point for the community that has been in the works for nearly 15 years and has never gotten this far. Buchanan Davis is a member of the Incorporation Committee and told the Arizona Republic he's excited to give voters the opportunity to decide their future. We're tired of sending our taxes to neighboring cities. We're tired of the lack of vision and the hodgepodge growth in our area, Davis said. He said residents are tired of playing catch-up on building roads and infrastructure. Davis said moving forward, the committee plans to host public meetings to answer questions about the incorporation. And that article is entitled, Santan Valley Residents Will Get to Decide Their Future. That was by Maritza Dominguez. Our next article is entitled, Saguaro National Park Purchases Adding 47 Acres. This is by John Leos. Saguaro National Park West will add 47 acres to its protected park lands in the foothills of the Tucson Mountains after an acquisition of two properties for the Trust for Public Land. The addition will strengthen wildlife corridors, preserve Sonoran desert habitat, and expand recreational access. The Trust for Public Land, an organization with a mission to create quality parks and protect green spaces, announced the addition to the park on April 25th. The new acreage adds to the organization's work protecting over 2,300 acres in and around Saguaro National Park since 1993. The land was purchased with a federal funding source called the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which comes from a portion of the federal government's offshore oil and natural gas revenues that are reinvested into protecting American natural resources. The Trust for Public Land also received financial assistance for project costs from Pima County and the Southern Arizona Hiking Club, a nonprofit volunteer group that promotes outdoor recreation. Saguaro National Park, encompassing about 92,000 acres across two locations, protects ecologically valuable and biodiverse Sonoran desert landscape, including a number of unique desert species like roadrunners, Gila monsters, desert tortoises, and the iconic saguaro cactus. The new park land will also bolster the linkage between Saguaro National Park and Pima County's Sweetwater Preserve, an 880-acre park that includes 13 miles of interconnected trails used for hiking, mountain biking, and horseback riding. The preserve was created in 2004 through a partnership among Trust for Public Land, Tucson Mountain Association, and Pima County. I'm beyond pleased to see Saguaro National Park West growing with this new addition of beautiful natural land, said Pima County Supervisor Jennifer Allen in a news release. Being good stewards of our public lands is one of the core principles of Pima County, as laid out in the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan, said Allen. It's an honor to see our conservation partner, Trust for Public Land, continue and expand that stewardship within our community. As the park expands, outdoor recreationists may soon be able to explore the new acreage after a public planning process is completed. Preserving the wildlife linkages is job one. Any new trail linkages have to go through a public planning process, said Michael Patrick, senior project manager at Trust for Public Land, so everyone will get a chance to say what they want to see out here before the park actually puts it in the trails and opens it up. And that article is entitled Saguaro National Park Purchases Adding 47 Acres, and that was by John Leos. This next article is entitled SRP Wants to Convert Coal-Powered Plant to Natural Gas. This is by Russ Wiles. The power utility company Salt River Project is pursuing a plan to convert a coal-fired power plant in eastern Arizona to one fueled by natural gas, a move that the utility says will provide environmental benefits and cost advantages. The move contrasts with President Donald Trump's recent order calling on utilities to burn more coal, but environmental advocates favor cleaner fuel sources than natural gas. SRP's management in late April presented a proposal to convert the Coronado Generating Station and start gas burning by around 2030. The plan was submitted to the Power Committee of SRP's Board of Directors and will need approval from the full board, along with a revised Certificate of Environmental Compatibility from the Arizona Corporation Commission. SRP's management hopes to have an approved plan in hand by June. SRP and its ratepayers would face a roughly $100 million price tag to convert to natural gas. SRP owns and operates the Coronado Generating Station near St. John's, and that means the utility doesn't need to get the consent of any partners. The company has been studying several options and working with the St. John's community to transition the power plant away from coal, said Grant Smedley, SRP's Director of Resource Planning, Acquisition, and Development. The plant has the ability to generate up to 762 megawatts of power from two units of roughly the same size. That's nearly 10% of last summer's peak demand at SRP of 8,200 megawatts. The facility has been generating electricity from coal since 1980. Trump administration calls for more coal. A requirement adopted last year by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency calls for costly new emissions control equipment at coal plants, though President Trump recently has voiced support for burning coal. In April, he called for the retention or reopening of plants, including the Chala Power Plant near Holbrook in northeast Arizona, which owner Arizona Public Service shut down earlier this year, citing emissions and high operating costs. A group of Republican lawmakers in the Arizona House and Senate has also called for more coal use by power plants, partly to bolster the economies of rural areas where many of these facilities are located. Like SRP, APS also has been working to reduce its reliance on high-pollution fuels, especially coal, and hasn't announced any changes in its plans for Chala, despite Trump's pronouncement. Also in April, the Trump administration delayed tougher emissions requirements for 68 coal-burning power plants across the nation, including the Apache Generating Station south of Wilcox in southeast Arizona, operated by Arizona Electric Power Cooperative. Natural gas still a harmful fuel, environmentalists say. Environmentalists, meanwhile, contend there are better options for the Coronado plant than burning natural gas, which emits pollutants, including carbon dioxide, though in lower amounts than coal. By converting the Coronado coal plant to gas, SRP will lock in new gas for decades to come, and its ratepayers will be forced to pay for the project's high cost, said Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, in a statement sent to the Arizona Republic. There are cheaper, less polluting options available, including solar power, wind, battery storage, and energy efficiency, she continued. Given these lower-cost alternatives, volatile gas prices and gas supply issues, gas generation is likely to become less and less economical. Barr decried what she called the significant impact of methane emissions from burning natural gas on climate change. It's a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, she said. But a natural gas conversion could be a bridge to installing more advanced technologies that could become more prevalent by the 2040s, Smedley said. Converting the Coronado plant to run on natural gas would result in carbon dioxide emissions there at a rate of two-thirds to one-half as much as coal for the amount of energy produced. Narrowing the options for Coronado plant. If the conversion plan to natural gas is approved for the Coronado plant, the facility likely would run only part-time during high-demand periods, reducing overall emissions further, Smedley said. Given the continuing high demand for power in Arizona, reflecting new residents moving to the area, the emergence of power-hungry industries such as data centers and other factors, SRP anticipates pressing power needs ahead, especially in the years around and after 2030. We're looking at all options to meet that capacity need, Smedley said. Other possibilities might include solar and biomass power, he added, while small-scale nuclear reactors also could be in the mix. Changes to SRP's workforce on the site would depend on what actions the utility pursues. SRP currently employs about 150 people at the Coronado plant. If SRP decides to convert to natural gas, the utility would need to select a gas supplier and arrange for a pipeline to be connected to the Coronado facility. SRP expects the conversion to cost around $100 million. Smedley described a natural gas conversion as a fairly low-cost option. This involves much lower capital costs than other alternatives, he said. For SRP customers, this plan makes the most sense. During its 2024 fiscal year, SRP relied on coal for about 16% of its power generation and natural gas for 38%. The utility aims to reduce the contribution of those two carbon-emitting power sources to 30% or below by 2035, Smedley said. That article is entitled, SRP Wants to Convert Coal-Powered Plant to Natural Gas, and that was by Russ Wiles. Now we're going to move on to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We'll start with two front-page articles, one on Berkshire Hathaway and the second on Mexico. The first is entitled, Buffett to Step Down, with a subtitle, Abel Will Take Over as Berkshire Hathaway's CEO. This is by Jonathan Stempel and Suzanne McGee. Warren Buffett is ending his career as perhaps the world's most famous and revered investor, saying he will step down as chief executive of Berkshire Hathaway at the end of 2025 and hand over the reins to Vice Chairman Greg Abel. The move caps an era for Berkshire after Buffett's extraordinary 60 years at the helm, which made him a household name, a multi-billionaire, and an American success story. I think the time has arrived where Greg should become the chief executive officer of the company at year end, Buffett, age 94, said on May 3rd as he wrapped up Berkshire's annual meeting in Omaha, adding he would still hang around and conceivably be useful in a few cases, but that the final word would be Abel's. The announcement prompted an outpouring of praise for Buffett from CEOs and investors. Warren Buffett represents everything that is good about American capitalism and America itself, investing in the growth of our nation and its businesses with integrity, optimism, and common sense, said Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Tim Cook, chief executive of Apple, in a post on X said, "There's never been someone like Warren, and countless people, myself included, have been inspired by his wisdom. It's been one of the great privileges of my life to know him." Buffett's move will propel Abel into the spotlight at Berkshire. Abel, who has long been identified by Berkshire to be Buffett's successor, may not have the star power of Buffett, although he is expected to preserve the culture of the conglomerate. Buffett said Abel and most of Berkshire's board of directors hadn't been aware of his plans prior to the announcement, though Buffett had told his two children, who are directors. Berkshire's board of directors will meet on May 4th to discuss the transition, he said. Abel, age 62, has been a Berkshire vice chairman since 2018 and was named Buffett's expected successor as chief executive in 2021. "I couldn't be more humbled and honored to be part of Berkshire as we go forth," Abel told shareholders. Buffett also said he had zero intention of selling any of his Berkshire stock, nearly all of which will be donated after his death. "The decision to keep every share is an economic decision because I think the prospects of Berkshire will be better under Greg's management than mine," Buffett said. Remarkable run. The decision to step down caps a remarkable 60-year run where Buffett transformed Berkshire from a failing textile company into a $1.16 trillion conglomerate with businesses across the U.S. economy. Buffett's own fortune totals $168.2 billion, according to Forbes magazine, nearly all of which is in Berkshire stock. Cole Smead, chief executive of Smead Capital Management, said after Buffett's announcement, he turned to his father, Bill Smead, who founded the firm, and said, "Well, that's the end of an era. It's sad, but it's life." Berkshire's stock price has risen 19% this year, compared with a 3% drop in the Standard & Poor's 500. Many investors have viewed the conglomerate and Buffett's stewardship as a safe haven from uncertainty about the economy and President Donald Trump's tariff policies. The question going forward is, will Berkshire still have a Buffett premium when Buffett is not there, said Kathy Seifert, an analyst at CFRA Research. "You're buying a stock, and you're also getting the investing prowess of a legend. With that legend gone, what is the value?" Greg can do better. Abel had already been taking on many of Buffett's responsibilities, including for capital allocation. Asked during the meeting how his oversight of Berkshire's 189 operating businesses would differ from Buffett's, Abel said, "More active, but hopefully in a very positive way." Buffett said Berkshire's board could make arrangements for the transfer of power over the next few months. "The fact that you could do pretty well doesn't mean you couldn't do better, and Greg can do better," Buffett told shareholders before the announcement. Berkshire's annual shareholder weekend, which Buffett calls Woodstock for capitalists, annually draws tens of thousands of people to Omaha for the meeting and for a series of shareholder events across the city, including shopping. The company has said it intends to continue holding the weekends. Many shareholders have said they will keep attending after Buffett leaves, though many believe attendance will drop. Buffett took over Berkshire in 1965, and with his longtime friend and business partner Charlie Munger, who died in November 2023, built it into an American success story. Headquartered in Omaha, where Buffett and Munger grew up, Berkshire now has close to 200 businesses, including Geico Car Insurance, the BNSF Railroad, industrial and chemical companies, utilities, Dairy Queen Ice Cream, Fruit of the Loom Underwear, and See's Candies. It also ended March with $264 billion of stock, including Apple, American Express, and Bank of America. Oracle of Omaha. Buffett became known as the Oracle of Omaha for his investing success as well as his folksy wisdom and modest lifestyle. While Berkshire's stock rose 5,502,284% from 1965 to 2024, Buffett never moved from a home he paid $31,500 for in 1958. Buffett was a disciple of Benjamin Graham, the economist and his former professor, stressing the importance of company fundamentals and not overpaying for assets. That approach often made it hard to deploy Berkshire's ever-growing cash hoard, which reached $347.7 billion at the end of March. Abel joined the former MidAmerican Energy, now known as Berkshire Hathaway Energy, in 1992, 8 years before Berkshire took it over. He later led that business for a decade. Buffett's fortune would have been much bigger had he not, since 2006, given away more than half his Berkshire shares to charity. Nearly all the rest is expected to go into a new charitable trust overseen by his daughter Susie and sons Howard and Peter. Abel will face challenges including how to help Berkshire grow meaningfully without overpaying for acquisitions, whether to pay a dividend, and how to deploy the cash. Howard Buffett, 70, is expected to eventually succeed his father as Berkshire's non-executive chairman to help preserve the company's culture. And that article is entitled Buffett to Step Down, and that was by Jonathan Stempel and Suzanne McGee. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled Mexico Rejects U.S. Offer of Troops, with the subtitle Shane Baum, Trump Has Proposed Deployment. This is by Lucinda Elliott. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said on May 3rd that President Donald Trump had proposed sending U.S. troops to Mexico to combat drug trafficking, but said she had rejected that offer because sovereignty is not for sale. Sheinbaum's comments were in response to questions about a Wall Street Journal report published on May 2nd that said Trump was pressuring Mexico to allow deeper U.S. military involvement against drug cartels to combat trafficking across the shared border. In one of the calls, Trump said, "How can we help you fight drug trafficking?" "I propose that the U.S. Army come in to help you," said Sheinbaum, who was speaking at a university event near the Capitol on May 3rd. "And you know what I told him? No, President Trump. The territory is sacrosanct. Sovereignty is sacrosanct. Sovereignty is not for sale. Sovereignty is loved and defended," the president said, adding that while the two countries can collaborate, "We will never accept the presence of the United States military in our territory." A spokesperson for the U.S. National Security Council said in response to a Reuters request for comment that Trump had been crystal clear that Mexico must do more to combat these gangs and cartels, and the United States stands ready to assist and expand the already close cooperation between our two countries. The council spokesperson added that Trump had worked closely with Sheinbaum to achieve the most secure southwest border in history. However, dangerous foreign terrorist organizations continue to threaten our shared security, and the drugs and crime they spread threaten American communities across the country, the spokesperson said. The White House did not immediately respond when asked by Reuters whether Trump had raised troop deployments with Sheinbaum. Trump has said publicly that the U.S. would take unilateral military action if Mexico failed to dismantle drug cartels. The two leaders have had several calls in recent months to discuss security issues, trade, and immigration. Sheinbaum went on to explain that during one of the calls, she had asked Trump for help to prevent weapons, which help fuel violence and trafficking, from entering Mexico from the United States. "We can collaborate. We can work together, but you can do it in your territory, and we can do it in ours," Sheinbaum said. The Wall Street Journal reported on May 2nd that tension between the two leaders rose toward the end of an April 16th telephone conversation when Trump pushed to have U.S. armed forces take a leading role in tackling Mexican drug gangs that produce and smuggle fentanyl to the U.S. In February, the United States designated the Sinaloa cartel and other Mexican drug cartels as global terrorist organizations, which some analysts have warned could be a stepping stone to such military action. Airborne surveillance of Mexican drug cartels by the U.S. military has also increased as part of efforts to collect intelligence to determine how to best counter their activities. Sheinbaum has since proposed a constitutional reform aimed at adding protections to Mexico's national sovereignty. And that article is entitled Mexico Rejects U.S. Offer of Troops, and that was by Lucinda Elliott. This next article from USA Today is entitled Israeli Military Issuing Notices to Reservists, and this is by Reuters staff. The Israeli military was issuing call-up notices to thousands of reservists on May 3rd to support an expansion of its offensive in Gaza, Israeli media reported, after the prime minister announced that his upcoming visit to Azerbaijan was postponed. The reservists will be deployed to Israel's border with Lebanon and in the occupied West Bank, replacing regular soldiers who will lead a new offensive in Gaza, the news site Ynet reported. The military had no immediate comment. Earlier, the prime minister's office announced that Benjamin Netanyahu was rescheduling his May 7th to 11th visit to Azerbaijan, citing recent developments in Gaza and Syria. The office, which also cited the intense diplomatic and security schedule, did not announce a new date for the visit. Netanyahu had been expected to meet with President Ilham Aliyev. Israeli media reported on May 2nd that the Security Cabinet had approved plans for an expanded operation in the Gaza Strip. Israel broke a fragile ceasefire with Hamas in March after seeking to extend it without engaging in talks to permanently end the war. Hamas says it would release the remaining hostages in Gaza only in exchange for an end to the war. The military has since intensified its bombing campaign and carved out wide buffer zones in Gaza, squeezing the population of 2.3 million into an ever narrower zone in the center of the enclave and along the coast and shutting off aid supplies. And that is all the time that we have for in this article entitled Israeli Military Issuing Notices to Reservists by Reuters staff. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, May 4th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can also take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.